Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com. The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911, and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Boat Trader is America's largest boating marketplace with over 100,000 boats to choose from. We offer simple, comprehensive solutions for those looking to sell, find, and finance new or used boats. Visit BoatTrader.com to get started.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Bow Hunter Chronicles podcast brought to you by Huntworth. Huntworth clothing for all types of weather, for all types of terrain, for all types of budgets. Clothing that works. Check them out at huntworthgear.com. So this is going to be the last podcast before Michigan's opener, before the end of the quarter. So if you want to get in on any of these giveaways, go to patreon.com/bowhunterchroniclespodcast. Sign up's like 17 cents a day, 33 cents a day. Huntworth is giving away their Elkins vest, a set of their new Ames gloves, and some of their Casper Heat Boost base layers, Kanadi arrows, zingers, Spartan Forge. Spartan Forge, you can go to Spartan Forge, spartanforge.ai, and save 25% off with code BOWHUNTER. It's already cheap. It's got incredible mapping. They've got their new Blue Force tracker. Actually going to be testing that out this week up where we don't have service to see how well that's going to work for us. And going to have Bill on the show, I think, in 2 weeks or so to talk about all the new features, the new LiDAR. We actually talk about the LiDAR on this podcast here. But we give away a year subscription to that. That gives you also the AI. So I've been looking at that as we're coming into the season, as we're coming into our Patreon hunt, looking at that and saying, okay, where are these deer going to be? We got cameras out so we can kind of have an idea of like where we want to be, what the deer are doing, why they're doing it. All that's in that Spartan Forge app. But Latitude giving away probably a set of their sticks again. You can use code BHC for 15% off everything at their website. Big Shot Targets to give away one of their targets. Code BCP will get you 10% off of everything over there. Lucky Buck gives away some of their mineral or some seed if you can't use mineral like we can't here downstate in Michigan. I think that's it. Maybe I'm forgetting somebody, maybe not. But all sorts of giveaways, all sorts of companies that support this show and allow us to give back. And that's what we do. The Marco Polo Group is going strong, building a great community in there and gearing up for this Patreon hunt that's going to be enormous. So really looking forward to that. Lots of good deer. But this podcast with Jacob Sklenner, met him at the Mobile Hunting Expo in Kalamazoo. Listened to a couple of podcasts. He's an engineer, so he breaks things down. And even we talk about it on the podcast, maybe too much. But with map scouting, organizing your pins and kind of how to break down the woods as you go through it. And then as you look back, I think this is going to help everybody. Great podcast. I think you guys are going to really enjoy it. Like I say, if you get a chance, go over to patreon.com. Shout out to our latest Patreon, Eric Schaub out of Bay City. Thank you so much for supporting the show. We'll get your swag pack out here very shortly. And a couple people have reached out and said, hey, is there still room at the Patreon hunt, et cetera, et cetera. Get a hold of me. We're going to try to accommodate everybody. It's going to be a ball. It was great last year. Weather's looking good. So get at me as soon as possible. And as we're going into this season, good luck to everyone. Oh, and a big shout out to Brad Collings, BDS Outdoors. Been on the podcast, done some video stuff with us. He's on my bow hunting league team. Just killed a buck the other day, and he is setting out to do 10 150 grain single bevel heads, 10 different deer this season. And luckily he's on my bow hunting league team. So we are on the board, Team Bow Hunter Chronicles. So yeah, that being said, thank you for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Good luck this season. Enjoy the episode. All right, everybody. Adam back with another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast. And today we're talking with one of the, I don't know if we should call him like one of the up and comers from the hunting beast side of things. Jacob Sklenner. Maybe you've heard of him on the Latitude in Session podcast or like Wisconsin Outdoorsman. Maybe you've seen his videos on the hunting beast there with Dan. And we got to talk to Jacob in person there at the Mobile Hunters Expo. And Jacob, I want to know how that initial experience coming to Michigan and your accommodations were here in this great state of Michigan.
Well, I got to say I loved it. I loved it because of the people around me. I feel like you're baiting me a little bit with this question here. We stayed in Kalamazoo, so we'll throw a little asterisk on there because I've been to Michigan, and most of the times I'm in Michigan, I'm in the UP, and I absolutely love the UP. But we were in Kalamazoo, and we like to pinch our pennies a little bit sometimes at the Hunting Beast, and we were in a hotel that had some stains of questionable color and size, we'll say. On some bedding, we had a few interesting characters roaming around parking lots, and that was kind of our initial experience in Kalamazoo. So that was, we'll call it interesting. But honestly, I love the area. I met a lot of people from Michigan there. Like I said, I have prior experience in Michigan, and I really do love the place. And honestly, I drove in there at the right time because I was seeing a lot of nice deer out in the soybean fields at that time of year, man. And it actually kind of got me thinking about throwing a hunt that way.
Yeah, Michigan, I don't know. I think we're maybe like changing some minds. Maybe we're opening some eyes. Maybe, you know, they say that hunter numbers are declining, and maybe those are the I just want to shoot my buck guys. And you have that in Wisconsin too, but.
Oh, for sure.
But yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, there's more and more deer, the more, and I think we'll talk about this later in the podcast, but I think the more work you put in, the better the deer become, I think. And I think maybe that's where Michigan has gotten a bad rap in the past.
Yeah. I mean, I would say in the short term, your return on investment with your time in the woods is linear, both in like, I'm an engineer. So linear means it's an equal amount increasing. So the more work you put in, you get equal result gain. And I would say it turns to exponential. So your returns are getting much and much greater over time. The more consistently you do that, because you start to rack up those experiences. And, you know, it can be really, really hard passing on deer, and especially on public land. Like, it's really hard to pass on deer and start to, you know, reinvent in your mind what kind of culture you hunt with, you know, what you want to take. But I feel like the transition happened easier for me when I started looking for the experience rather than the animal. And, you know, sometimes it meant shooting a smaller buck, and sometimes it meant that I felt I hadn't experienced enough, hadn't learned enough or gained enough out of that season, you know, to hold up for something bigger in some of those cases. But man, is it an addicting feeling when you start to to set a tight goal and in a hard place in a hard state, and you achieve it. And, you know, that's a kind of happiness that I wish anyone, no matter what they're kind of killing.
So, kind of on that note, like, what is your hunting background, and how did you end up, you know, working with the Hunting Beast and all of those guys?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I, typical Wisconsin kind of growing up scenario, my dad was always a part of a deer camp, and I was quickly thrown into that as well. I grew up gun hunting actually in Florence, Wisconsin. So we would drive through Iron Mountain. If some of your listeners are more familiar with that, we'd drive through Iron Mountain, and not very far from there, we'd hunt Florence and the Nicolet Shequamagon National Forest, which huge area. So I'm not, and there's not giants there, so I'm not really worried about getting it away. But yeah, it was a total deer camp culture, and I just fell in love with the culture to start. And once I went off to college, I became really intense about it. I'd started doing solo bow hunts in college, in high school. And I got into bow hunting a lot more. And then in college, I just completely dove into it. I had actually discovered in my last 2 years of high school, Dan Infault's original Blood Brothers DVDs, Collecting Dust in the Basement, and started watching those. And man, I have an engineering mind. I'm mechanical engineering degree. And man, did that get the gears turning to figure out how to pattern deer and kind of solve them like an equation. That was just, man, like, that was the coolest thing to me. And I wrestled in college as well. And that is where my work ethic comes from, and my willingness to go to any kind of depth and any reach to achieve my goals. It comes from that. And combining that with wrestling was just kind of a recipe for disaster as far as my passions go. Like, I was completely head over heels for it. A lot of the things in my life started getting less attention because of how much I love hunting. And
knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Boat Trader, America's largest boating marketplace, offering easy financing and over 100,000 boat listings to choose from. Sell, find, and finance new or used boats on America's largest boating marketplace. Visit BoatTrader.com to get started.
Seeing how Dan Infault was getting it done on public land, I started messaging him and some other guys to the Hunting Beast Forum, and I learned a lot through that, and I became familiar with Dan, and Dan became familiar with me over time. And my goal was really to put my first big buck down on public land. And going to school in UW-Platteville, southwestern Wisconsin, there's a lot of big bucks in that area. And I had a lot of people that I knew in that area, and many that were actually offering me permission to hunt on their land because they knew me through wrestling or back home and they own property out there. And I would literally turn down these pieces where people were, you know, shooting giants because I really wanted to get it done in public. And eventually I had a year where a lot of adversity happened to me. I had broken my collarbone at the beginning of the wrestling season. One of my friends actually slammed me and broke my collarbone right at the beginning. I had basically totaled my truck. I had like a 3-cylinder misfire. I had my bow get stolen. I had all these things kind of affect me where I was in a tough spot with pretty much no money, no bow. And I had this goal of killing a big buck on public land. And through the kindness of some really, really nice people in the local area, I got lent a bow by a local archery shop, a few arrows, set it in. And I just was like, man, I got to keep pushing. Like, I got to make this happen. And sure enough, that year, called my shot, explained on video, because we were just doing it for the memories. Recording my hunts, and I explained in a video exactly how I was going to kill this deer and how I planned it. And sure enough, the buck come in like I planned it, killed it, super dramatic recovery and everything. And it was just one of the most amazing experiences of my life with some of my best friends. And I got 90% of it on video, and it was amazing. And so I messaged Dan and I expressed my gratitude, of course, for all of his strategy and stuff. And I said, well, I'll be moving back in a couple of years back to southeastern Wisconsin by you. And I said, I'd just love to share this film with you so you can see it, because it's some of the best memories of my life. And so he's like, you know what? You should come over. We can do an interview, and I might be able to use the footage for my channel if it's good enough. And, you know, we talked for like 3 hours that day I first met him, and we did interviews on it. We talked for a couple hours afterward, and we just really kind of hit it off from a hunting and friendship almost perspective. And he was like, you know what, like, you should probably start recording for us. Like, you should keep recording your hunts and make stuff for our channel. And that was, you know, obviously a dream come true from a young kid, you know, starting to get his way into big bucks on public. You know, one of the guys I really look up to there. And yeah, ever since then, I've been recording for the Hunting Beast. And I recently this year started my own channel to kind of supplement it and be kind of a sister channel to the Hunting Beast, where I not only show my kills on the Hunting Beast in my channel, but I go on my channel much more in depth into the tactics that get me there as well.
So prior to finding those Blood Brothers DVDs, like, what was your hunting style and what was like your success rate or the caliber of deer? Like, so when you started going to those camps with your dad, you know, what was the hunting style? What was the culture?
Yes. So it was mostly gun hunting. I would say 95% of it was gun hunting. And our scouting was walking, logging trails and trying to find deer tracks and find a heavy trail or something. You know, we were just looking for travel, and it was kill pretty much whatever you saw. You know, we were meat hunting. It'd be awesome if it had antlers, but we weren't really too worried about that. We would spend a week up there and we'd see probably five deer, you know, an entire week at the very most. And I loved every bit of it, but my success was nowhere near where it is now. And then in high school, before I kind of discovered those Blood Brothers DVDs, and I started just cutting my teeth bow hunting, which my dad had stopped doing for a few years. And that's kind of when I picked it up on my own. I was like, man, I can do this hunting thing more than just 7 days out of the year. I'm going to go try it. And so, you know, sitting field edges, CRP edges, getting the shakes when I see a 6 point at 200 yards, like that was it, man. I was thrilled to have does come by. I was thrilled to try and shoot a doe, and, you know, very, very little success. Didn't really understand what was going on. I just remember finding those Blood Brothers DVDs and heard all this amazing stuff, like bedding, and bedding just enthralled me. And, I remember going on the forum. My first question I ever asked on the forum, I made an account so I could ask this question, is when the hell did deer bed? Like, everyone's talking about all this deer bedding, but I don't even know what time of day they bed. And I was excited. I was looking for beds and stuff like that. And I would sit right over them, but I had no idea when deer even bedded. Cause it's funny. It's such a moot point that people just skip over. It's kind of like granted knowledge. But, I remember asking that. And then 2 years later, after being absolutely, you know, head over heels for it, looking back and seeing how much I learned is just amazing. And now I can look back at that time frame and know that my knowledge is way more than 10 times what it was then. And it's really amazing to see. And now my success is far greater. You know, like, I don't want to put inches range on the bucks I'm trying to shoot. But what gets me excited now is far greater than what it was then. You know, like, I don't typically like to shoot many things if they're, you know, inside the ears, unless they got a really tall rack. And, you know, I'm not necessarily selecting for an antler size, but my goal is to shoot something maybe 3.5 years old if it's got some special genetics, but 4.5 or older is kind of what I'm shooting for. And it's more so, you know, I don't say that to be condescending to people. I say that because I'm challenging myself. Like, I purposely seek out public land and purposely seek out pressured areas. And I want to kill the hardest thing there is out there to kill. And I think that's a cagey old whitetail. And gets me excited to know that everyone else is trying to do the same thing I am in the same area with the same equipment. And I was the one to outsmart that smart animal in the woods and get it done. It just, it's much more gratifying experience to me.
So when you found those Blood Brothers DVDs and you kind of started asking the questions and doing all that stuff, like, what was the one moment, like, in the woods? Because I can tell you for certain, and I'm by no means a bed hunter or anything like that, but was there a moment that, like, it clicked for you and it was like, this will work. It's right. Like, I can't imagine it was killing that deer and calling your shot on your first go around at this.
Right. Well, I would say it was the year before that. That year before I actually ate tag soup. When I was in college, I killed 4 bucks in 4 years. Or I killed 4 bucks in 5 years and ate tag soup one of the years, but they were all on different properties. And you know, they got progressively bigger. I killed like a 108-inch 9-point the first year, and they progressively got a little bigger. And that nice one I killed was like a 133's 10. And so the year that I ate tag soup, which was the year before I killed that 133's 10, I was sitting on an area, and it was kind of like early pre-rut. And I found a bunch of bedding, and because of the way it was in grassy open area, it wasn't as intelligent, and there were a bunch of beds. Like I was like, oh, I recall this in DVDs. Like, I think this is doe bedding. And you know, it, my past kills that I'd had on those decent bucks for that area were more, I want to say, luck. You know, like one of them was opening day because I had a trail camera on a field edge. I checked it, and the buck happened to be doing the exact same thing the next day. I, that's preparation and stuff, but you know, this, it's not a mature buck, and 99% of the time that buck's going to smell your scent and be out of there, especially over a food source on public. But it was kind of that scenario type for the next two deer I'd killed. So I was selective the year after, ate tag soup, and I had found this doe bedding this year. I was like, man, I think this doe bedding, you know, this is on a point of a ridge. There's a trail that runs below this. And from what I've seen on these videos, I think there's going to be a thermal rising from the bottom. I think there's going to be a wind going down the point of this ridge. And I think right downwind of these does is actually where that thermal tunnel is going to occur that you hear Dan talk about so often. So that's when the wind current from the sun hitting that ridge, heating up that land, causes what really is thermal expansion of the molecules. So the water molecules in air expand, which causes them to be less buoyant or more buoyant than the other air, and makes it rise. That's why you see heat rising and cold falling. So when it's hitting that ridge, it's causing that heat to rise up that ridge, and it's causing the wind from the other side going the opposite direction. When those two currents meet, they create kind of a tunnel where a deer has a really unique opportunity to smell what's below him from that rising thermal and what's kind of down that ridge or coming from the main wind direction. So he can smell in multiple directions. I found this doe bedding, and I was like, man, this sets up perfectly for a buck to come cruising, you know, in this area. And before this, I had just been throwing a lot of sits on faith. You know, I'd been going by these strategies. They weren't always paying off. You know, it was usually day late and dollar short kind of scenarios. And this one, I was like, man, I have no trail camera data. Like I don't have a whole lot of experience, but from everything I've heard, like, I think this might work out. And so the next morning when it sat there, and I had like a 130 come, and he cruised down that trail and then J-hooked around into that doe bedding. And he just had brush covering the whole time, and I couldn't get a shot off. But to see that buck do like exactly what you think would happen, where he scoots down that thermal tunnel, you can see him looking down the ridge, looking up the ridge, you know, he scoots around me. I just barely miss his current because I'm really high up in a tree, and that I have that main wind catching me, went over him, and he didn't smell me. And then him curl back around, go right up into that doe bedding and check for does. It's just like exactly what I had seen described so many times. And it was to the point where I was 1 foot in my old tactics and 1 foot in beast tactics. And I was like, it's just time to commit. You know, it's time to believe in this. I seen the case in person that I need to start having faith in this. You know, that season I was so close to killing bucks so many times. And you know, it just took one more year for me to get it done. And now ever since then, I've been following it somewhat religiously and having a lot more success.
And so in doing that, and are you strictly a bed hunter? I mean, I think that that's what always you when you think about Dan, it's always surrounding bedding. I mean, I guess like I can think of the one hunt where he shoots the doe in the snow where he's just shooting, you know, I guess it's bed to food, but it's not like Dan in fault. You know, you get in there without making a sound and the right. deer stands up and you shoot him. From the hunting bee standpoint, like, is that where you're at now is like like, I guess, Jake Bush style, where you know where every bed in the county is, and you just pick which trail you think is going to be the right one?
Yeah, so I would say all of my sits have bedding in mind. All of my sits are bedding oriented. You could call me a bed hunter through and through for sure, but I think I'm kind of resistant to say that because the initial person's going to only think about bedding when they first discover this kind of strategy. And that's where it takes some, you know, it takes some cutting your teeth. It takes some developing to start to get this strategy down, because most people think about bed and they don't take the time to figure out all the other factors that go into direction of travel from that bed, when that buck is using that bed, gauging if it is buck bedding or if it's doe bedding or if it's young buck bedding or mature buck bedding. I think there's a lot of other factors that go into it. But I think those factors mean a whole lot less unless you understand where that deer's coming from. And ultimately, that deer's coming from or going to his bed, you know? So I would definitely call myself a bed hunter because in these pressured areas, they don't make it far from their bed on either end of shooting time, really, unless it's, you know, peak rut.
So from that standpoint, do you think that your previous hunting helped you or hindered you? And what I mean by that is, when you talk about, is it young buck bedding? Is it doe bedding? Is it big buck bedding? You know, there, I feel like there is a faction of, you have to get out there, you have to make the mistakes, you have to see things progress, and then you can you know, recall that. But then from your side of it, from an engineering standpoint, the way that I, from listening to you, from Jake Bush, from people who have that sort of, I guess, spreadsheet type mind, right? Yeah. It would seem, if it's an equation, then if you learned the equation, you would never have to have hunted before, find these things, plug them in, and be successful.
So I see both sides of that. So the equation isn't always the same. Not every buck is going to have the same personality, and not all the same factors are always going to be at play. It's funny because a certain equation always reminds me of me trying to plant deer hunting, and that's a stress factor and life cycle equation. So when you're looking at machinery and you're looking at certain metals, you're trying to decide what metal fits for the best application. There's all these different factors that get weighted, and you basically place your confidence in those factors along the line. And every time you have less confidence, it takes away, or this metal doesn't fit your purpose. It takes away from that metal's quote unquote score, essentially. And so the way I look at it is, I want all of those factors to align. You know, in order for me to feel like I'm even in the game and it's worth calculating, I want to find a bet. But I want to find food. I want to find certain direction of travel, his track. I want a basing on the time of year he's using it, like if it's related to doe bedding or if it's related to an early season food source, late season food source, stuff like that. So there's a lot of factors that go into it that don't make it as cut and dry as just learning the equation. I want to extrapolate on that more, but it's kind of difficult. I would say that you can't just learn the equation and then you're good to go. I think it's a very experience oriented thing. But once you have all this experience in, and you can relate prior situations to your current one, like you can take the data, let's say, that you've gathered in your mind, or recorded if you're me, and you can take all these things you learned over time, or, you know, what you've seen deer in the area doing at this time of year historically, you can apply that to your current situation. So that can cut down your learning curve like crazy. And as you probably are familiar with, if you've listened to other podcasts and stuff, I spend a lot of time looking at maps and analyzing data and stuff like that. And that's because I can spend a lot more time doing that than I can in the woods. Cause I got life going on, you know, like I work a 9 hour, no, I mean, 45 to 50 hours a week. And, you know, my work follows me home quite often. I do a lot of editing and stuff like that. I can't always, you know, I got family, a girlfriend. I can't always get out in the woods to do what I really would rather be doing, and that's scouting and gaining that experience firsthand. So I take the limited amount of experiences I have and I gather every tiny bit of data I can from them, and I make sure I'm certain of what factors are truthfully there and what actually influenced the scenario. And that serves to kind of cut my learning curve down. I call it like forming your instincts. When you're new, and we'll call me new here, because I feel like if you're in this learning mindset, you always feel new. Like you always feel like you're a student of the game. But when you're new, you don't necessarily have the instinct that a Dan Infault or an Andy May or some really experienced guy might have. And I think that's a great thing. I think you have the opportunity to, you don't have to listen to every single thing that people say and call it fact. I think you have the opportunity to try these scenarios out and see if it applies to what you're doing. And so if you record your observation and you really break down every bit of it, I think you have the opportunity to really gain an instinct based on what is true for you in your hunting situation. Whereas if you just believe, you know, a Drury or a Higgins or something like that, and you're like, man, this, you got to have this food plot or whatever, and you spend 10 years getting really good at food plots or something that just doesn't really apply to your situation, like hunting a field edge if you're on, you know, pressured public, then you formed the wrong instinct. You know, it's like in wrestling, if you practice a move incorrectly 1,000 times, you basically didn't practice the move at all. You actually are making it harder for you to learn the right way to do it. And so if you start fresh and you vet those strategies and you base your experience off of, or you base your knowledge off of actual experience, then you stand to gain knowledge a lot faster than someone that spent their entire growing up, you know, reading magazines and watching Buckmasters and Realtree and whatnot.
Yeah. Just kind of, regurgitating things instead of like actually living them. And I would think, and I know I've heard you shy away from it, but I would say that that would be the person that would tell you.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You have to do this or you have to do that or everything. This, you have to do this every time. And, you know, I think if you've hunted enough, you've seen enough deer, you've had enough encounters, like everything a deer is supposed to do, if you got a bow or a weapon in your hand, they've done the exact opposite when they needed to.
Oh, yeah.
Just, you know, that one more step, or they should have, or, you know, so deer don't do anything every time, right?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of people hunting out there, and especially talking about mature bucks, which keep in mind here, like, most of the time I talk about what I do and why I do it. It's because I have mature bucks in mind, which, you know, they're kind of a different animal, it seems like, at times. But I always say, like, you know, if mature bucks would do what we think mature bucks do, they wouldn't be alive. You know, like, we have all these strategies and all this stuff that everyone preaches and disagree and bicker and argue about it. And it's like, if they did what people thought they did, people would kill them a lot more often. And the fact is, no matter who you are, that deer is winning a lot more than you are. And so I always tell people to keep that in mind. You know, like, if you see something that's atypical, ask yourself why. And if you can figure out why, and then maybe use that the next time the situation pops up, you know, you stand a much better chance than if you just believe what someone would say.
For sure. Now, you had mentioned doing a lot of map scouting and also like factors in this equation. So if you're looking at a new property or you're looking at something for the first time, on a map, what are those factors that you're looking for so that you can say, oh, okay, this part doesn't work and this, okay, this might work and this, like, how are you prioritizing like the features on them, on these maps, these properties?
Mm-hmm. So, the first thing I do is when selecting a property, I look into things like talking to locals, talking to people that have hunted the area. I'll talk to farmers, DNR biologists. And I look into that and I kind of get a feel for, you know, genetics. I get a feel for, you know, what people mostly call genetics. I get a feel for what kind of class of buck is in the area. Like if the area is truly holding what I want to hunt, and then I'll focus my attention on that area of a state. And then from there, I like to look for what properties I believe are being overlooked. Sometimes in an area of a state or a state that has lower pressure, I'll select a larger property with a lot of features that I like Fitz Hill Country. I'm looking for diverse, complex ridge systems with different clear cuts, different openings, CRP, agriculture mixed in, just a lot of different features that provide well for bedding, food, and want to hold those deer to that area. So that's what I'll look for in a large property in Hill Country, a large property in Marsh Country, which I'm hunting now. I like to look for expansive cattails. I think deer just survive well in cattails. You know, tamarack swamps work well. Just an area where gun pressure can't always kill them, you know, where the deer can stay hidden and they can survive. Surrounding agriculture to give them plenty of food and stuff, nutrients. I look for that a lot. And once I've kind of identified that property on a large scale, if I find that there's a whole lot of pressure and I wasn't expecting it, I actually look for small pieces and lesser known pieces. Like in Wisconsin, we have VPA, MFL, CFL, all sorts of lands that are kind of a little bit less known. We have a few conservancies, things like that, that most people might not know as public. I look for those, and I look for small chunks adjacent to really, really large chunks. So some of my best pieces that I hunt are 60 acres adjacent to 2,000 or 40 acres adjacent to 5,000. And the bucks have the same genetics as what everyone else is chasing on that giant piece that's 1 mile away. But it's often getting overlooked because everyone wants to have the option to keep chasing a deer. And you know, you might find one to two spots on that whole 40 or whole 60 or whole 90 that's good. But it can serve really great because it's probably getting a fraction of the pressure per acre as that really large piece. Because nowadays, you know, everyone wants to go in deep. So when I select that property, like I said, I'm looking for a diverse cover or a large expanse that keeps those deer alive. And then I'm just really trying to narrow down their bedding. You know, I'm trying to, in Hill Country, I identify all the ridges that are leeward for the predominant wind. So that wind is coming from the opposite direction that they're facing. So, you know, if you typically have a west wind, I'm looking for a lot of east facing slopes that go downward to the east. And I'm looking for those slopes occurring on points that have little kind of jut outs. I use a lot of 2-inch or 2-foot contours, and I use a lot of LIDAR mapping to try and identify, you know, unique knobs. And I look for any, as much bedding as possible for that predominant wind. Cause you know, it's all an odds game to me, you know, like it's whatever best supports, you know, that deer being in that situation. You want to stack as many factors in as you can. And I think bucks bed in mature bucks bed in an area that gives them the most advantages. And to me, that's a leeward side where they have the potential to smell below them and above them at the same time. And so I look for a lot of bedding. I prioritize the areas that are like that. I look for bedding that is downwind of common human access. So I'll turn off the leaf. I'll do leaf off mode. I'll look at logging trails. I'll identify where I think people are getting to. I'll cross off areas I think people are getting to. And I'll start to make that map that's huge look a lot smaller. And I'll usually come to about 20% of the entire map is an area that I think a mature buck's going to spend time in. And then with the remaining time I have, I just burn it boots on the ground. You know, like in a marsh, it might be isolated cover that I'm looking for typically. But I just burn boots on the ground. And I check out every one of those areas I can. A lot of the times that's checking little poplar groves or cedar groves before that bedding. You know, if I have 10 places to scout in a day, I'll check an area that I think a mature buck rub should show up if he's using that bedding. And I'll use whether there is a mature rub there or not to eliminate areas that I might not have time for. So I have 10 areas and I can only hit three in a day. And three of these ridges are blown up with rubs, you know, 200 yards from the supposed bedding. And six of them are okay and the rest are trash. I'll prioritize those three. And, you know, there might be a big buck on each of those ridges, might be a big buck on another one. But I'd say my odds are a little bit better for the one that's absolutely blown up with rubs. So I'll look for that. I'll look for bedding that gives me high confidence of a time of year. So stuff that has a lot of shade. I'll look for like a north facing slope for early season. So it's, it retains shade quite a bit. I look oftentimes for stuff that is downwind of what I suppose to be doe bedding. So, you know, if I identify doe bedding boots on the ground right away, I like to hunt bedding and identify buck bedding that's downwind of that typically. Thick cover, stuff like that. I like buck bedding that's downwind of that. It helps me have a little bit of an incentive on when that buck's going to be there. The same thing with marshes, but marshes is a lot more manual effort. You know, it's a lot of actually touching absolutely everything because, you know, they're in some really off the wall places. And then once I go out there and I scout, I look at where, you know, my tracks and my markers have led me. And I start to stand back and identify what was I overlooking. You know, like what are the spots that I thought were great right away? And what are the spots that I don't think a human's hitting? And I didn't consider at all. And, you know, with the time I have remaining, I'll go check those out. And those can be some of my best spots. You know, there's plenty of times that these are duds, but, you know, there's little patches of timber right off of a lot or, you know, some cover that just seems like it should have got hunted. And a lot of people are thinking the same thing. And I'll go check those areas out, and some of them pan out great and some of them don't. But basically, I'm going with my highest odds scenarios first. I'm going for where I think that mature buck's going to be bedded based on all the intelligence factors I think a mature buck uses when he beds. I'll try to focus in on those beds that I have a certainty on the time of year. And then I'll start looking for overlooked spots and see if those pan out for me.
And when I was talking to some of the listeners about this podcast, one of the things that kept coming up was when you're doing your map scouting, how are you telling like the different types of trees? Like if you're looking for oak trees or things like that, like what is it that are you able to do that? Or do you have any tips for that?
I used Onyx for this in the past, but Spartan Forge, man, if they have UAV imagery, you can zoom way in and you can actually see, especially in the shadows of the tree, you can kind of see the branch structure of that tree. So I've been able to identify oak trees doing that. But in the past, it's been using different times a year, usually fall imagery. You know, I'm looking like late fall, right around, right before leaf drop. And I'm looking for trees. If I'm looking for oaks, you know, a lot of the times you'll see just that patch that is still holding leaves a little bit later, or they look like orange cauliflower, essentially is kind of what they look like on the top. And you can kind of see that localized cover. The one that's, I'd say, is easiest is poplars, your aspens and cedars. You know, it's going to look like cedar is just going to be like kind of like a green blob. Poplars, you're going to see little white branches breaking out, and usually they're in little isolated patches. And I just find that, like, you know, bucks love to hit poplars. They like to hit a lone cedar, you know, they like to hit that lone pine. And that's areas that I'll identify beforehand, and I'll mark them as areas to check out, qualify whether it's worth pursuing that bedding before I go check it out. And I guess that's kind of hard to explain over words, but really, the easiest one to identify is those poplars with white tops, cedars coming up next. And then, once you get your boots on the ground and you are in an oak patch, mark it and then go back on that map. This is the whole recording data thing. Go back on that map and see if you can differentiate between what was oaks and what wasn't. And soon enough, you'll have marked that enough and you'll have gone back and checked your map enough that it becomes a little bit of second nature. You start to see trees in a different way. Another thing too is like thickets. You can actually kind of identify thickets and maps with leaf off imagery because the whole ground will look super shaded. And it's just because there's so many branches in there, even when, you know, the leaves are off, they're thick. You know, if you can dial it to any day that you want, there will be green there when everything else is brown. But, even if everything, it's like the barren winter and there's no snow on the ground, you'll see that that area is shaded because there's just so much more stem count in there. That's the other thing I identify sometimes right away too.
And so you had mentioned, earlier and just kind of like in passing, and you said you're using SpartanForge a little bit more. They've now got the LiDAR, and I know you had said before that like some of the Wisconsin maps have LiDAR also. How are you utilizing LiDAR? Like, can you give an example of like where that is better than regular topography, or you know, what, how you're using that specifically?
Yeah. So LiDAR, I guess not all LiDARs are built equal, because some of them actually use like 10-foot gradient. So like they start to show difference at 10 feet, but specifically the 2-foot difference or 5 foot and less, it's typically two, shows just so much detail. And I love using that in hill country. Doesn't do a whole lot in marshes, because kind of like cattails and stuff plays with it a little bit. You know, it's hard for them to differentiate sometimes. But in hill country, man, like you can go down a point and see every little tiny knob. You know, if you think about 2 feet, you know, a buck probably needs like a 5 foot area, 5 foot wide, or, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 to bed. 2 feet, you're going to see those tiny little outcroppings on ridges. You're going to see those little dimples, often coming off of like small drainages. Those, man, I love using LiDAR for that. And then also benches. LiDAR is really, really good for kind of seeing that little bit of relief in a hillside that's what normally would be steep. Gosh, LiDAR is great for that. And so to me, LiDAR is identifying those tiny little outcroppings, those tiny little knobs. And those are areas that, you know, I'm dropping a waypoint to check out right away for bedding. What's nice about those features when you identify them is, whereas a giant ridge point, a buck can't see the other side of it. You know, he can't see down the whole length of it necessarily. He can't see all around it. So, you know, he's got to go on faith or go on wind or go on his sight and hearing to try to monitor the areas that he can't observe. In a small knob, that buck can see 360 around it. And if he gets that wind direction coming back from the mainland out over the point to that knob, like, he's in a pretty hard to kill setup. And you know, that's the deer I'm trying to chase, is the ones that are hard to kill, because those are the ones that's going to live a long time. So, yeah, any little tiny knob or bench or possible relief where they may be traveling, it's something that becomes a lot more apparent in LiDAR than it does in topo, for sure.
Yeah, I'm thinking in my head of like Southern Ohio and some of the things that I saw down there, and kind of even going back, like, so I bumped a couple of different deer off of these points. And when we went back, when like the leaves were off, so it was really difficult, you know, they could see forever. And then also an area where there was a bench and there were scrapes on it and all the stuff. And it was kind of like, it did look like it was just steep. Like if you were down in the bottom, you couldn't recognize it. And then when I was up in the tree, I was like, I think that there's something up there. So I climbed up there after the hunt, and I was like, man, this is where I needed to be. Right. You know, but like you said, like going back now, I've got those spots marked. So to go back with LiDAR and say, okay, can I identify these things? And then can I extrapolate that to the next spot or the next time? So when you're doing things like that, of that nature, how are you organizing this information? Because I'm absolutely terrible, like with my map pins, and especially ones from like last year, or ones that I do like e-scouting and ones that I do like boots on the ground. Like I don't label them correctly. So I have to look at like the dates, and I'm like all the colors, I just like whatever I was feeling that day. Like, so with that type of information, like how are you organizing it so that or is it just your mechanical mind can say, oh, I know, I've got all of this.
I do not have the best mind in the world. so no, I don't always have all of it. But I would say I do a lot of categorization and I do a lot of color coding. I use Onyx for this. I just think, I mean, I haven't experimented a whole lot with marking points in SpartanForge, but man, I love Onyx's system for it. And so what I do is I use icons. I always use a different icon. I make sure that's appropriate from the get-go, but I have kind of a color coding system. I use red for human danger. I think red signifies danger to me, so I use that for other hunter sign. I use aqua, that kind of light blue color for access. You know, the alliteration just makes sense to me. But my access routes and common access routes for other people, I draw those and I keep aware of them. I use brown for old sign, historical sign. It's kind of how I see a non-fresh rub. And so that's how I generally think of it. You know, you see old tracks, old scrapes, old rubs. I use that as sign I kind of want to keep an eye on, but, you know, it might not be the thing I'm hunting over or basing my sit on. I use that gold color, that yellow, for hot, fresh sign. It's like fire to me, you know, so I categorize all my fresh sign that I come across, and obviously that date's attached to that point. And I'll often take a picture of that as well. And I put that in a folder for, you know, mature buck, fresh or whatever. And I put in a folder for the time of year as well. Just so I get a general feel. And so that's how I mark hot, fresh sign. I mark blue points for extremely high confidence spots, pink points for possible spots. So like if it's something I want to go check out, and it's possibly what I think it is, I'm going to mark it pink. If it's something identifying the map that's making, you know, light bulbs trigger left and right, I mark it white. You know, it's something that really, really stands out against the map. And then when I place trail cameras, I mark them in black, because I don't use black for anything else. And I've recently started using green. I used to use green for your run-of-the-mill average sign, probably not a mature buck, but just good sign, good stuff to keep aware of, good screen. And so what I do is I mark all those with those different, the correct waypoint that I want, the right color that I want. And what I can do is filter all my waypoints by color. So like if I want hot sign, and I'm just struggling like mid-October, whatever, what I'll do is I'll filter all my points to be hot sign and blue sign only. So stuff that I know is mature, stuff that I know is fresh. And then I'll filter the dates down to the kind of range that I'm about to be hunting. And so I can historically all across the state see like when that hot sign was popping up. And then I'll throw in the red and I'll see, well, when did I mark hunter sign in this area? Do I think hunters have been back to it yet? Or do I think there's someone hunting it right now? So it's kind of, and you can in your mind probably see how that works. You know, like if I got folders for doe bedding, mature buck bedding, stuff like that, all this stuff categorized, it really just takes a couple clicks at that point to zone in on what I want to see for this time of year. Like it's scrape week, man. I want a fresh scrape. Well, last year there were 10 fresh scrapes in this area. I'm going to go hunt it now. You know, that's kind of how I leverage it. And, really doesn't take a whole lot to take a picture, throw in a couple notes, change the waypoint type, change the color. That 10 seconds, 20 seconds on the front end, man, does that pay off, you know, going down the season when you know where the sign has popped up historically, and you can just keep building off of that experience.
And so are you, whether it's in the app or somewhere else, are you like journaling your hunts to go back and kind of look and see what happened last year? Is everything done like on the maps?
So I previously just kept notes on waypoints, but I've actually started, I made like an Excel journal that, you know, has like a drop-down menu and I can click a bunch of different options. So it has everything under the sun that you could think of. And so I'm going to start doing that this year to keep like an official journal. I think it'd be really cool to look back at it. I also film all my hunts. So, you know, I can always look back at film. I'll keep an encyclopedia of what happened that year. And anything that was eventful, I'll save. And, you know, you can just look in your file system by date. That's a good way to do it too. But trail camera data, I keep an actual Excel sheet of trail camera data. And I use that. I look at the wind, the temperature. I look at the dew point, the time of day. I look at the time of year. I look at, you know, precipitation, how far away it was away from a wind switch, if there was a wind switch during the day. I look at everything you could possibly imagine. And then I also compare it to what the yearly averages were. So if it's an abnormally hot time of year, abnormally cold, abnormally wet, all these different things. I look at all of those factors and I use them to kind of sort through my data for trail cameras. And what that really does is like when you go and you pull cards at the end of the year, or you're, you know, reviewing all your cell camera footage and stuff like that, you don't have the freshness in your mind of what was going on that time of year and what the temperature and weather and stuff was like, and especially in those unique spots. And what it does is it makes the patterns that those deer may be on, or the conditions that they prefer when they are in that area, extremely apparent. So that's like the really heavy hitting recording I'm doing is with my trail cameras. But as far as like my hunts in general, I had a pretty general way of recording it. And that's when I kind of leveraged my mind, just remembering it for the most part. But trail camera data, a stuff where I wasn't present and don't have as much of a intrinsic connection to what happened, the stuff that's harder to forget, I actually record that and then I break it down on a basis of everything you could imagine, essentially.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate here a little bit. So don't take this the wrong way. I'm just, so for the listener, right, there's guys out there that are probably saying, there's no way in hell that I'm going to do this. And so at any point, I mean, obviously there's a way, there's a word like obsession, right, where that can have a negative connotation. But it would seem like at some point it could take the fun out of it. So are you that way in like the other portions of your life where everything has so structured that it's all about the end goal? Or is it like, because some people like the journey, and I think that maybe that in some ways when you're outlining that stuff, and you said earlier, like maybe some people do it in their mind and some people, you know, haven't been able to do that. Like the old guys, the guys that trap, or like the Dan Infaults, or I know Andy's kept journals forever. I don't think I've heard Dan talk about that so much. But that like woodsman, that stuff probably leads to woodsmanship. Do you think that there's going to be like a day that you're like, well, I don't need to keep all this data because I have 5-10 years of patterns that I know now what it's doing?
Yeah, for sure. No, definitely. I mean, to me, it's just right now it's hard to even say obsessed or passionate, you know. It just feels so much deeper than that for me. Like it's odd to say to someone that may not feel the same way. And I'm not saying it's you, but probably some of your audience. Like I feel like my purpose in life is to be out here in the woods and help people do it as well. You know, that's what I find value in myself from. And so it's in all those aspects, it doesn't take the fun away from me. It just excites me so much to be learning about it. And I think this is a way that helps me learn. In other areas of my life, I'm certainly not like that. You know, like I'm not nearly as obsessed about anything like I am about hunting. I'm not recording all this data and stuff like that. But you know, at the same time, taking notes, you know, always helps my memory. But yeah, I mean, there might be a day when that comes. You know, sometimes I'm pretty sick of going into this Excel sheet and taking weather underground data and copy and pasting it in for all these different trail camera pictures that I get a mature buck on. But like right now, it's justified by how much I love it. So, you know, I think eventually someday that I will shy away from it. Especially like the hard driven data aspect of it. But I don't think it will necessarily be because I don't need it anymore. And I don't think it's helping me, because I think it is a strategy that can always help someone. Like, even on my recent trip to Nebraska, like the way that I recorded data and tracked previous encounters is something that helped me like crazy, where Dan suffered from not doing it. And he actually reaped some of the benefits of my doing it as well. So even a guy like him can benefit from it. But there have been years and there's been times and months and parts of the season where I don't do that because I just want to have that wild experience again. You know, like I don't want it to be based on just this data. I just want to go by that feeling, you know? And I think right now in my career, I'm not killing enough giants every single year to tell myself I've done enough learning to just go off of that. And I'm putting a lot of focus on like trying to get as good as I can as quickly as possible. But you know, out of state trips, stuff like that, like, man, I'm just out there slinging arrows. I'm out there having fun, and it's not all about that data recording, you know, at those moments. But, I think it's something I could always benefit from, but it's not something I'm always going to do. You know, if I don't want to do it and I get sick of it, I just want to go out there and go off what's in the noggin, like I'm going to go for it. I don't think anyone has to do it too, to be good either.
So in recording all this data and using it, to find success and having success using it, what is the one or two bits of information that you've gleaned in all of this, you know, data collection that, you know, maybe people don't talk about, or that you thought, oh, that's not a big deal, and it turns out like these little things are what kill deer?
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
I would say there's a lot of information out there nowadays that's right. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's right. I think the thing that people neglect a lot is how unique each buck is and each scenario is. Because there are times that, you know, that buck is just not, like, it's not doing what you think. But one thing I found that I think a lot of people, this leads to a lot of people being discouraged, but everyone talks about bucks habitually using areas. Man, like, I found that I could be right in a buck's bedroom, and it's a big deal if that buck does the same thing 2 days in a row pressured by it. And it's, I mean, all of last year, I never saw a buck do the same thing 3 days in a row. And only three instances did I see a buck do the same thing 2 days in a row. But there was almost always a reason that that buck was doing what he was doing. And the key is focusing on that reason and not that you think this buck is just going to habitually use that area. And you think about what that means too. It usually means that once you get that cell camera picture, that was the day and that was your window. If, you know, if he doesn't repeat the next day, which they didn't do the vast majority of the times, even in their favorite bedrooms, you know, that means you're missing that data if you wait for that picture. So I think that's something that a lot of people don't emphasize. You know, everyone likes talking about the scenario where they found that buck wants to be, and he shows up day in and day out. And, you know, when I went to Nebraska recently, I saw that, and because it was an extremely unpressured area, like, I saw the same bucks doing the same thing 3-4 days in a row. You know, it's early season, hot conditions, and unpressured area, and that's reasonable. But just because you're not seeing that doesn't mean that you're not doing the right thing. Now, as far as factors that led to the bedding, I don't think enough, or led to me killing, that people don't key on. I don't think enough people talk about how the pre-rut can make bucks habitual, how bucks can actually favor certain doe groups and favor those times of year. And year after year, their most consistent patterns for me are pre-rut and rut. And it's because they work that cycle. I mean, again, I'm talking mature bucks. They work that cycle of does in their preferred order, you know, the order that they know they come into heat, over and over again. And so, you know, there are 3 day gaps where I'm pretty sure a buck's going to show up in this area, and he might be a mile away, you know, might be in the next area he hits. And someone's going to look at that in a GPS collar, or someone's going to look at that on their cameras and be like, damn, this buck's going everywhere. He was here one day and then he was there a mile away. But relative to what he did last year, he's actually being pretty consistent. So I think that's something not a lot of people talk about, is how they almost get more patternable when they're thinking with something other than their brain, we'll say. And I think two interesting things I picked up on is wind switches and dew point. I noticed when that dew point's like just fading out, like just when that dew is coming off of the grass, is right around the time they've pretty much settled their bed. Or times when the moisture is heaviest in the air, we'll say, are times that I get a lot of movement. I think it has to do with their confidence and ability to being able to scent and win the things around them. It might be a factor, just, you know, time of day, like the dew points and humidity typically correlate with the beginning and end of your day. But that's when I see bucks doing a little bit more movement, a little bit more shifting, is when they get a wind switch that provokes them to move their bedding a little bit, especially if it's a drastic wind switch, they'll move a little further. And especially in times when there's a lot of moisture in the air, that's kind of when I see them making some moves that you wouldn't typically expect of deer. But, you know, you can really only key in on those if you understand where he is in the first place. So that might not be something that everyone wants to just focus on right off the bat. But if you know where he's going to be you might want to be targeting at one of those times.
I'm trying to think of like how that, I guess you're just saying that the deer are on their feet more when there's more moisture in the air. And as the moisture settles out, then they want to be back to their bed.
Yeah. I mean, I'm concerned that it is that factor, that it's just that, that as the moisture settles out, they want to be back in their bed. But I honestly do believe that it's because scent is held better in the air. You know, when there's more moisture content, there's more H2O in the air, it holds scent molecules. And I honestly think that they have higher confidence, you know, roaming around at that time. You know, it's not something that plays a huge factor, but it's something that I've seen enough that it's kind of like, you know, tripping my trigger to it a little bit. You know, it's not something where like I'm only targeting during this time. That's the most moisture rich time of the day. But honestly, I do see a little bit more movement on days that are a little bit more moisture rich, especially on like scrapes and stuff like that too. When, you know, post rain, I see it, and I truthfully believe it's not them trying to refresh that scrape. I think that water is reviving a lot of scent molecules that are hidden in that scrape, and it's a great time for them to get inventory. I actually think it improves their ability to smell that scrape rather than, you know, disintegrates it.
So this gets asked a lot of different guys in different scenarios. So I'm going to ask you same thing. Like if you had to pick one day, because you got all the data, that you doesn't matter. I know you're going to say, well, it depends on the piece and blah, blah, blah. But if you had a crazy work schedule and everything, and you said, Jacob only has one day to hunt to kill a big deer, like what day would you be hunting?
Yeah. So I'll give you my scenario for the two areas I've been hunting. I'll give you my scenario for southeastern Wisconsin. And I'll give you my scenario for southwestern Wisconsin. Southeastern Wisconsin, marshes, opening day. I want to be out there opening day. If you had to give me a week, it'd be opening week. And that's just because, like, man, those oaks are a freaking draw in the marshes. And if you can beat it, I found that in these high pressured areas, it's not beating someone to the oak island. It's beating them to the adjacent bedding ground. If you can hit that before they really hammer the heck out of that oak island, because everyone's walking a mile out in the marsh on Oak Island nowadays because of Dan. No offense to him. You know, it's good advice, but it's kind of been overworked now. If I can beat them to that best bedding that monitors that favorite food source of that time of year, that those bucks are going to be around, man, that's hard to beat. But if you had to throw me in western Wisconsin, I would honestly say like October 24th or 25th. And if I had to pick a week, it'd be the 21st to the 28th. And, the reason I say that is because I got some doe, like fawn drop dates and some doe, you know, heat patterns to the point where I had does bleating and bucks chasing and grunting after them on October 18th and October 20th were just insane rut action. And it was just wild because it was those first does coming into heat. I really like that pre-rut period because those bucks are starting to get, they're in their ranges that I've been able to observe them the majority of the year. And in their ranges, I've been able to monitor them the majority of the year. They're starting to move a little bit more and they're starting to move in accordance to does more. And that makes them just much more susceptible to my strategy. You know, it's a little bit, the does can bed pretty much anywhere in a cattail swamp, you know, anywhere that's dry. But they're pretty selective about thickets and a little bit thicker areas and CRP and stuff like that in hill country. So, when I have a buck bedding down and, I know he's going to be moving in relation to does and he's going to be doing it a little bit earlier and he's starting to get ornery and compete with other bucks, man, that's a special time to be in the woods.
So in that scenario, are you, I know you just mentioned buck bedding, but are you kind of throwing out that, attacking the buck bed, are you throwing that out the window to favor downwind side of doe bedding, you know, just travel corridors or how is that, what's the strategy there?
So I'll focus a little more downwind side of doe bedding when, as long as the pressure hasn't hit yet, when it gets right in towards that peak rut, like early November, late October, that's when I'll shy a little bit more away from buck bedding. If I believe it's places where bucks aren't coming from bedding on the piece I'm hunting. Like a lot of times the piece isn't big enough to hold the bedding, but they'll come to doe bedding on my piece. I'll cut the travel between them. So I'm thinking of the sign and I'm thinking of the doe bedding always in relation to where that buck's coming from, where his bed is. So it's never completely out of my mind. I don't necessarily forego it in order to be downwind of doe bedding, but it's certainly a great scenario to be in when you aren't pinpointed at a buck or his bed. And, you know, say you've just busted out a lot of your high confidence spots and it didn't quite work out for you. That's not a bad place to be, is downwind of doe bedding, you know, especially a place where a buck can wind a lot of doe bedding at one time and check a lot of different individual doe beds for that one in heat. I like being downwind of really, really thick thickets, in that late pre-rut to rut, stage. I like being downwind of extremely thick thickets because those does that are getting, disturbed by bucks constantly, I love to go in an area that's really hard for a buck to get his antlers through, and they know he's coming and they know they can hunker down or get away. That's when you'll see like those really thick areas with just like rubs torn up on the outside. It's just like a doe in heat hauling herself up in there and bucks, you know, rubbing up like crazy on the outside, marking, defending their territory, defending, you know, her, their right to her, keeping other bucks away. That's when you get some really special sits. So I love that. But really in that pre-rut frame, I'm just noticing them adjusting the direction they're traveling and the length in which they travel in daylight a little bit more. So it's very in relation to buck bedding, but I'll give you a scenario where it changes a bit is if I have multiple buck bedding going towards a localized doe bed, that doe bed or the doe bedding area becomes a hub, you know, it becomes the more centralized place for that, those deer to be traveling to. So, again, it's a game of odds. You know, if I got four buck beds and, 100 yards away, I have one doe bed that all those bucks are going to go to. It's probably a lot better for me to hunt closer to that doe bedding than it is to one of those buck beds that may or may not be getting used and may or may not be getting used by the buck I want to kill.
So in that scenario, are you hunting? I mean, because it seems like Dan only hunts evenings, you know, when he's attacking mm-hmm. these beds. So are you of that same, you know, camp, or are you saying, okay, well, as we get further into the rut, now I'm hunting all day, like in that week. Okay. So like you said, you know, October 21st to the 28th or whatever, mm-hmm. are you doing all day sits at that time? Or are you, mm-hmm. what are you doing?
Yeah. I'm doing all day sits. And my all day sits aren't always sitting in the same stand. Usually I'd sit in the morning in a high confidence spot and then adjusting to deer movement and moving a little bit further. If I see nothing, I'll hit another spot for the afternoon. You know, so nowadays you'll have a cell cam pop off in an area and you'll move there in the afternoon. So I'm usually doing some kind of movement, unless it was like I was set up perfectly. And if I get out of here, I'm busting everything on the way out. I'll sit in the same tree all day if I have to, a lot of the time. But, you know, let's say I don't have a super high confidence morning area. I'll observe in the morning. You know, I'll sit back in an area where I can hop up off of a creek and get way up in a tree, or I can be on a ridge side watching an area that I think a lot of action is going to go down. And I'll make an adjustment in the afternoon according to what I see in the morning. I really like employing that strategy, and that's something that actually helped me a lot in Nebraska this year. You know, obviously it wasn't rut. You know, it was September 1st and on. But a lot of my afternoon sits turned out a lot better, as you'll see as these videos start to come out, because of observation in the morning. And it was certainly a blast doing that.
And so Wisconsin starts here tomorrow, right?
It's Saturday.
Okay. So I know it's pretty close. So what's your early season strategy? What are your plans? Are you going to be tagged out by Sunday?
That's the goal, man. You know, we scout all year to get it done as soon as possible here. But my strategy here, if I had to give you an opening day scenario, one, I'm going to wait till Friday. I'm going to wait till tomorrow to look at the wind, because I always get my hopes way too far up and then that wind direction changes and I got to completely relocate. I have less confidence going in more to opening day if I relocate. But so I'm going to go in to an area that I kind of like to gauge where the pressure is going to hit at first. And my first sit is going to be an area where I'm not certainly sure that someone's going to be there. You know, I'll be scouting my way in and observing and whatnot. I'm not definitely sure someone's going to be there, but I think it's quite, quite remote that it's going to receive pressure as the year goes later on. So I kind of want to get in there while it's still a good spot before it gets busted up. That's probably what I'll spend my time opening day doing, is outskirts of what right now is a hot dropping Oak Island, is what I'm thinking. And then, you know, there's obvious bedding cover on the isolated areas around there. I'll phase to that probably second day if, you know, progressing into that first week of the season. And then off of that isolated cover that's obvious, like your patches of willows and stuff like that, there will be just tiny little whippets of red brush and just tiny little things on the side, the little dry points that probably couldn't even get a tree stand into. And that's what I'll start to focus on after that. I fully expect people to, as the season goes on, start busting up the Oak Islands, you know, if they're not doing it already in the early season. And then I expect them to eventually discover the, you know, those isolated trees that they could probably get a stand in, but I don't really think they're hunting much areas that they got to hunt on the grounds when their feet are wet. And so that's kind of going to be a big strategy for me. And of course, scouting my way in, making sure that that buck I want is truthfully in that area that I'm about to be hunting. That's how I'm going to kind of go about it going out in the season, and just bumping from piece to piece. You know, if I bump out a deer, it's no big deal. You know, I put in hundreds and hundreds of miles in the spring and in the summer, so I can keep moving to other pieces if I screw something up. So,
well, awesome. Now, if you do kill opening weekend because of the tag situation and everything, then what do you do? Because I think, like, one of those things that us as hunters, and I think myself and, you know, my buddy Josh has said it very articulately, like, once you punch that tag or that, you know, second tag or whatever, like, in here in Michigan, like, it's over. And, you know, for as many hundreds of miles that you put in the woods, you know, to kill on opening day and have the bow season be over, you know, how would that sit with you? I mean, we love the chase, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's got to be a hell of a deer to kill opening weekend, honestly. But at the same time, there's always stuff I can do related to deer hunting. You know, Wisconsin, if people aren't familiar, you get one bow tag, one gun tag. Gun tag is almost always like a meat hunt for me because the pressure is just crazy during gun season here. It's absolutely wild. So I don't really hold out for something great. Sometimes I'll save that tag for muzzleloader season. I'll bow hunt during muzzleloader season using that gun tag. And because we have a lesser weapon law. And, you know, I've gotten some great opportunities then too. So, I got at least that a little bit to look forward to. But, honestly, when I'm in an area that's fresh, like, I'm just going to keep bumping around scouting, you know, I'm going to keep figuring out more about these areas. And it's, man, you get a lot of intel when you can just blow up an area and figure out exactly what that buck's doing. You don't have to stop at a certain amount of sign or a certain proximity to that bedding. You can get some really, really cool intel. You can figure out, you're going to drop a lot of yellow waypoints, you know, like you're going to find out when that fresh sign's popping up, pretty much anywhere. So I love doing that. I'll sit back and observe. I'll get a hell of a lot better at editing videos. I've been working really hard on that for this series at least, but I'll get better at that. You know, there's a lot I can do. I'll even just go out and do a sit like I'm hunting and won't bring my bow. And a lot of times it's with a buddy, you know, trying to get him on a deer or something like that. But man, I just love watching deer. I love when that guess turns out right, you know, and that just is what the thrill is to me. And sometimes I get to punch that trigger, sometimes I don't. But man, I'm obsessed with it. And really, it's just not even about the kill to me anymore. So like, if I see something I want to kill, I'll kill it. But it's not going to rob me the experience of hunting, because it's about so much more to me than just punching that trigger.
And so other than the Honey Beast, like, what's your channel? Where can people follow along? And if they've got questions or anything like this, this stuff, like, how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah. So, my personal channel is The Wild Calling. So that we're The Wild Calling on YouTube, and we're Wild Calling Outdoors on, Instagram. I believe it's the same on Facebook as The Wild Calling, or Wild Calling Outdoors. You can message me on Facebook. You can, you know, follow along on my personal profile. It's just my name, Jacob Sklenner. I'll be posting all my videos and stuff on, Instagram, and I'll be posting them on Facebook, so you know when they're coming out, for YouTube. And, you know, you can message me anywhere. You drop a comment, I respond to every single comment on my YouTube videos. You know, I respond to everyone that messages me. So if you have a question, you know, feel free. It might take a second to get back to you, but, you know, I'm more than happy to help. And please share, you know, if, like, you have some success too, especially if you you learn something from the videos. You know, there's nothing greater to me than seeing someone find some value in the content I bring them. You know, that's my life's dream right there.
Awesome. Well, before we wrap it up, there's a question that we always ask, and John's not here, so I forgot. So what is your bow setup? Like, what's your bow, arrow, broadhead setup?
Yeah. So, there's a big story to how I got the bow. I shoot a Hoyt RX4. You know, I was telling you about the first time I ever had a video with Dan in fall, I broke my collarbone. I wasn't gonna be able to afford a bow for a very long time. I carried that deer out of my shoulders, and I was really inspired by Cameron Haynes that year. So the whole summer I was doing that lift front shoot and bought the Keep Hammering shirt. My whole motto that summer is to keep hammering. So when I got to that point where I was ready to give up, I just had that motto ringing in my head, and I carried that buck out on my shoulders like I'd seen Cam Haynes do before. And I sent him the video and I said, like, hey, thank you for inspiring me. I had all this stuff happen to me, but your motto kept ringing through. And, you know, I got it done and achieved a lifelong dream. And he said, wow, man, that's awesome. I think you deserve something a little more than just a buck for your efforts. What's your draw length? And I about put myself and he sent me an RX4, and I haven't even talked to the guy since. I've tried telling him thank you a few times, but he's gotten so popular. But yeah, that's why I have that bow. I'm absolutely blessed to have that thing and to be able to kind of carry on that legacy that he has there. But yeah, besides that bow that is extraordinarily special to me, I shoot VAP arrows. I think it's like a 400 spine. And my total weight for my arrow setup is about 550 grains. I have a 95 grain outsert on the end and a 125 grain G5 Montech. I just love that. I love cut on contact blades. I love that three blade. It punches a really big hole that it's really hard for them to, you know, just sit on and cover up, because them big bucks are tough, especially when they get in these corn fed areas with their fat hanging off of them. And I really have been loving shooting micro diameter arrows lately. Man, the penetration is just ridiculous.
Awesome. Well, thanks for taking the time, and I think people are going to really enjoy this episode. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on, man. It's been a blast.
Country. Rules were not created by man. Don't miss Wild Country, Wednesdays from 7 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Primos. Speak the language. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
Once in a while, it's fun to go like just full-blown redneck on these fish. This is like high-tech cane pole fishing right here.
From the white sandy beaches to the crystal blue waters, enjoy the best fishing Panama City Beach has to offer during Chasing the Sun. Sundays at 9:30 a.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.